All right, hi everybody, and welcome to lecture 37 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're continuing with the story of archaic Athens today, and we are tracing the steps in its development towards the world's first democracy. The starting point is very similar in all essential regards, really, to the starting point we find anywhere else. So that, I mean, you know, that, I think that's to be expected. I think that makes sense. The Athenians didn't start in any particularly different way than anybody else, with the exception that, you know, the scale of it, the scale of Athenian monarchy in terms of the city-states of Greece and that little peculiar arrangement, I suspect, had something to do with the dynamic that we are going to observe. In other words, just these subtle differences, these small differences in the way that Greek life, Athenian life in particular, unfolded, I think those contributed something to this different story that we're going to see. I would never say that was the main cause, but I think there's something to that. It's interesting because when the founding fathers look back on Greece and they look back on Rome, as we will see later in our story as well, they did spend quite a lot of time talking about the importance of the size of a government and the size of a country. So this would not be something that we might consider to be an essential truth about the nature of government, how big it is, right? Is a government good if it is going to help, or is ordering a society of 100,000 people, or ordering a society of 1 million, or 100 million, or 1 billion? Should that matter in terms of how the government is structured and ordered and so on? We might not be inclined to think of size right off the top of the beginning of our thinking about that as really important. But it is. And the founding fathers recognized that. And when they looked back at Greece, they did a considerable amount of thinking about the way that eventually democracy worked and other governments, and this was one of their considerations, the size. So to me, it's interesting. I personally haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it, but I'm more inclined to be interested in this question nowadays. And one of the things that the founding fathers were quite concerned about when they made the United States was they said, it's going to be too big. It's going to be too big. And they went back and forth and they said, if we're going to have a society of individual rights, this whole thing, this giant thing that we're going to create, a United States, it's going to be too big and it won't work. There'll be new problems that arise just by virtue of the size of the thing. And then, as we've talked about before, in Federalist number 10, and Kenny brought this up, James Madison talks about the issue of representation as being a mechanism for implementing a republic and for protecting rights in the context of a really, really large country. He thought, and the founders thought, that was a mechanism. So that was a part of their reasoning, that they could create a big republic and using a system of representative government. But it was a really big challenge to them. And when they look back at Greece, they really thought, well, here's this interesting idea of democracy, but notice that it only works in this really, really small setting. And we're going to get to this, you know, when we get to the end of this progression, we're going to see Athenian democracy. And what we're going to see is, well, it's small. And that's a part of how it works. It's small, and we already have talked about why this matters. Because the people are all connected in important ways to each other. It's an intimate society. It's not an anonymous society. It's a society in which everybody is related to everybody else. And there's this respect that pervades the society for all of the various members. And they are expected to participate in it and make it work. And so all this to say, size matters. And so that's why I am emphasizing kind of this theme here concerning Athens, because it figures in this. It might not be that easy to kind of figure out how exactly, but I think it's one of the reasons why Athens became different. Now, you know, you can look at all the other Athenian city-states, and you will see that, and there's not that much information about them, but you will see all kinds of different governments. So size by itself does not explain anything in history. So you can have really big governments, like the communist government of China, or you can have a really big government, like the Republican government of the United States, and obviously they're completely opposite. So, you know, size is not a determining factor, but it's something to consider. It's something that is just one of those features that you have to take into account. It's real, you know, it's something that you've got to factor in and understand about any society or any government and how it's going to work is the size of it. And this little community, this small, isolated, tribal kind of community of Athens in this archaic time is going to have this evolution that we don't see anywhere else. And it has a lot to do with size. It has a lot to do with the Athenians responding to the context that they were in and making a government of a certain kind. So, let's see here. Just to recover some of the context from before, if you're looking for the self-test for today, I'm just telling the live students that I've tacked it onto the end of the November webpage. If you're listening to recordings way down the line, you're going to see this on the December webpage instead. Okay? So you'll just have to sort out where to find that. But anyway, for context here, we can just look at yesterday's self-test just to set the context of this intimate setting in Athens, right? And we have this setting where, well, it's not that different from anywhere else, except for the size. We have a ruling family. That's not particularly exceptional. The Medontidae is their name. And the reason why they are the ruling family is because they are the descendants of Medon, a heroic ancestor, and who defended Athens in that preceding Dark Age, made sure that Athens remained Ionian instead of Dorian, the invaders that were coming in. And so these are heroes, and as a result, a character like Medon was a great hero, and as a result, his descendants were considered special. So they were known as Eupatrids. They were sons of a noble father. Now, the Medontidae were not the only Eupatrids. They were just the ones that, however this had happened, we don't have the details, however it happened, they became the most prominent ones. They were at the top. And so they were, the kings were chosen from among the Medontidae. So that's where we started off last time. Or rather, that's where we ended off last time. And so now what we're going to see is how this arrangement evolved and how this led to a different type of government for Athens. Not democracy at first, but a different type of government. I'm going to do a little bit of whiteboarding today, which is unusual, but I don't always want to do this. One problem is I can't have the clicking of the keyboard in the recordings all the time. But today I don't have a lot of visuals to show you, so I'm going to go ahead and put a few things on the whiteboard. And the first change that we're going to see in the history of Athens was that the rest comes in circa 753 BC. So we're, you know, not long after those Olympic Games, those first Olympic Games, and the story is unfolding here. And we have the Medontidae in charge, but the Eupatrids, the rest of the aristocracy, are not satisfied with the arrangement. And so they also, right, are sons of noble fathers. They also want a share of the power. So we don't know the details. We don't know if there was a war or just a big argument or whatever. I mean, if I had to guess, there might have been a civil war. Or at the very least, the threat of a civil war. Because typically changes like this don't happen unless you have the violence or at least the threat of violence. But basically, come 753, the Eupatrids got some concessions from the Medontidae. And so as of this time, the king was no longer chosen from the Medontidae only. Okay? He would be chosen from among all the Eupatrids. So he was to be elected by all the noble families together. Okay? And what they would do is they would convene every 10 years in order to choose a new king. So this is the most interesting kind of innovation. The king would only rule for 10 years. So there's a name for this. There's an adjective that means lasting 10 years. So this type of arrangement is called decennial kingship. Okay, so the Eupatrids stepped in and they said to the Medontidae, we want a share of power. In fact, we want a king to come from some of the other noble families. And so, you know, perhaps in order to soften this or to make it more palatable to the Medontidae, maybe this, what we'll do is we'll split the power. We'll have it rotate more often than normal, right? Because normally, right, what would be the normal, if we had to put an adjective in front of kingship, normally we don't, you know, even think about it, right? Because normally it's just always the same. But now that we have a different kind, decennial, and we're going to differentiate it from the traditional kind, well, what word would we use to refer to the traditional kind so that we keep the two sorted out in our heads more usefully? What would you put here instead of decennial to characterize normal kingship? Normal obviously would be one word, but it's not very descriptive. So what would be the best word to describe normal kingship? Normal monarchy. Think about how it works, right? Keen, go ahead.
I feel like it would have something to do with, like, until death or just family line. I don't have
that. Yeah, right. It's okay, good.
It's necessary, but okay. that's what we're going to be working with.
Good, exactly. The concept we're looking for here is the one that relates to the fact that the king ruled for his entire life. Then what happened? When the king died, what happened? Let's keep going and you guys will figure this out. I want to do this more inductively here. When the king died, what happened, Theo?
If he had a son, then he would rule.
Okay, right. So he passed it on. The kingship was an inheritance. And so Juliet has already skipped ahead to the answer, but she can't speak because she's got a loud environment. So Juliet said, hereditary. Very good word. Okay. So we think of hereditary. We apply that word, you know, to traits of people, like the color of their hair or different features of, you know, how tall they are and stuff like that tends to be, these are hereditary traits, right? But in this context, we can also say hereditary kingship, right? In the sense that was the norm. One ruling family, it always stays in the family. It's always the eldest son. And so that's a different kind. Here we have a whole other type. It's a decennial kingship. And there's also another term that we could apply here. We could also say, elective kingship, which is another kind of, it's both. Okay. The distinguishing trait here of this particular form is that it's decennial. But there, oftentimes in history, you also encounter this type of term to describe the situation in which a very select group of people are the ones who get to decide who the king is. Now, this is always a feature of a certain arrangement, okay? And that arrangement is called an aristocracy. This is a new form of government and that we need to now kind of wrap our heads around, which if we had a reason to study it, we probably would have had a chance to talk about it more in Egyptian history, but it's not a very clear-cut case. And there's not really any good reason to talk about it in Mesopotamian history as well, even though you would find examples of it. But, you know, whenever Egypt broke up into those periods where there is no pharaoh, and then you have a bunch of nomarchs in charge, that would be an example of Egypt returning to aristocracy, where you have a sizable group. It's still certainly not one, and it's not a few either. It's a group, but they're all kind of a group of equals out of a high rank, and they each of them have control over kind of a certain amount of territory, and they just have this arrangement where they all work together to keep things going, and it's kind of a club of petty rulers working together. And you find this throughout history in every society as well as an alternative to monarchy. So in archaic societies, monarchy is the norm and aristocracy is pretty much the only alternative that anybody has other than total anarchy. So there's nothing particularly special about this. It's just a time when you get an aristocracy when the individual ruler and his dynastic family have to admit that they are relying on others and have to share power, and the power becomes more distributed. So you can see that. The example that probably some of you are familiar with, especially if you've been doing history at our house, would be the system in Europe called feudalism, where you have the dukes and the counts and all of those characters, the high-ranking lords. And in England, they were called the barons, right? And they, all of them own a certain amount of territory. And they, all of them have their private armies. And basically, if the king is weak or if they're rebelling against the king, they at various times have an aristocracy where the group of these local rulers is in charge. No single person is in charge of the whole, but rather a large group is in charge of various parts and they cooperate with each other. So we call that an aristocracy. And we see that everywhere. I mean, no matter what society you look at, whenever they're in, no matter what archaic society you have, such as, you know, ancient India or ancient China or ancient Japan, any society where nobody's really thought of something more sophisticated, you basically are stuck. This aristocracy is still part of the archaic plateau. It's still very much stuck at that level. Because all you're doing with aristocracy is you're taking the power that was concentrated in the hands of one and you're distributing it to many. That's about it. Who are these many and where do we get the term, right? Because if you have, notice here that this is a common root word with democracy. Which means what? What's this part of the root word that is common to democracy? Theo, go ahead.
Well, maybe it would be the rule of.
The rule of, right? Okay, so then the question becomes, who are the aristo, right? Because in democracy, we have the demos, the people. Well, in aristocracy, we have the aristos. Who are they? So the aristos, whoops, look at that autocorrect. That is a non-historical autocorrect, right? The aristos were the best. That's what aristos means, the best. So aristocracy means the rule of the best. Best by what standard? Who's the best? Who were these Eupatrids? Why were they the best, Theo?
Well, I assume this means the nobles.
Yes, indeed, right? So nobility, right, is kind of synonymous with the idea of being better than others. So what makes them noble? Why are they the best?
Well, I assume So they probably have more money than everyone else.
Yes, that's true. But that is a symptom, not a cause. Okay, and Julia says, because they are the Eupatrids, right? Well, okay, keep going. Roll with that, Keen.
Because of their lineage of the hero. It's in their blood.
Exactly. Okay, so that's the beginning of the concept of aristocracy. Okay, so the Eupatrids, right, were the best. Because they were sons of noble fathers. Okay. So it's very similar to the concept of hereditary monarchy. This is hereditary aristocracy. It's just, you've got the noble bloodline. So you are the son of some ancient hero. Okay. But they themselves were the warrior class, okay, responsible for the defense of the city. So, there was a hereditary component to aristocracy, but maintaining aristocracy had this component to it, which was you still had to go out and bash some skulls in order to be an aristos, right? To stay on top, you had to be able to justify your status as the best. You had to go out and shed blood for the city. Otherwise, you didn't get to call yourself the best. It's not like you get to just inherit the term, and then from then on, you just prance around, and everybody says, oh yeah, he's the best, right? And they're just going to be satisfied with you being in charge for the rest of your life and your descendants and so on, just because your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather saved the city once. Right? So there was still an active component to aristocracy, in certainly in a time like this, and that was that you had to do these really, really important things in order to maintain the city. So you could maintain this presence within the society. You could maintain this status, this prestige that you had as an aristocrat. You were a Eupatrid. You were a warrior. Okay, so that when the city was under threat, which it was periodically in ancient and barbaric times, you got into an argument with the neighboring city-state, and there had to be a war to settle it, or nomads came and you had a problem and you had to deal with that, and so on, then, you know, these people were really important. And if you've ever read Homer's stories having to do with the Trojan War, especially the Iliad, I know that is some pretty heavy slogging for reading for students of this age, but there are some modernized versions of it and kind of simplified tellings of it, and there are movies about it. So, yeah, Timothy, it's much more the Iliad than the Odyssey here that is kind of valuable as a way to capture this concept of aristocracy. Because if you and if you've seen the movie Troy with Brad Pitt, that's a pretty decent kind of, again, representation of what it is that I'm going to drive at here, which is the role of the great warriors in war. In primitive times, certainly with the Greeks, war was not merely just sheer barbarism, just everybody runs and hacks at each other until it's over. Okay? It was more theatrical than that. It always has been in more civilized societies. War has always had a certain kind of theatrical component, because it's this staging of great conflict between peoples. It matters. It's not just an animal conduct of violence, right? So when human beings get together to mass murder each other, they symbolize it. They turn it into a ceremony, and it becomes this elaborate system of behavior. And you see this especially if you've ever wondered, you know, if you watch movies about the British and the British Empire and these guys wearing their red coats, and they all stand in line and they all march in a straight line, and they all then the officer yells and they kneel and they shoot, and then the other guys stand and they go forward and then they kneel and they shoot, and it's all this structured form of behavior, very, very ordered, very theatrical, strange in certain ways, and sometimes so impractical. But that's what I'm talking about, the theater of war, this strange feature that nobody here has ever had to live through, thankfully, but, you know, it's part of what we need to understand about the past, that human beings regularly engaged in these conflicts, and there was an art to it. There was a form of ceremony involved in the way that people fought. And if you watch the movie Troy with Brad Pitt, you will see a little bit of that in the way, and if you read the Iliad, you'll definitely see that, in the sense that the war is going on, but these great warriors pick each other out in the battle, and they confront each other. And when that happens, it's like everything freezes. The one great warrior from one side sees the other one. They eyeball each other across the battlefield, and they just start marching on each other. And pretty soon, they're confronting each other one-on-one, and everybody else stops fighting around them. And they form this big circle, and everybody wants to watch the great warriors battle each other to the death. And when that happens, it's as if the war stops, and the most extreme example of it is when the entire fate of the battle hinges on one warrior versus another. In the case of the Trojan War, there's a great battle involving Achilles and Hector for the Trojans. And so that's also very well dramatized in the movie Troy. And it's, again, it's one warrior against another. This is part of the mystique of the Eupatrid warrior class. Okay, these guys are really big, you know, impressive warriors. They have the wealth, as somebody mentioned. So they've got the best weapons. and the best metalworking and so on, and they can buy the best, and they've got chariots and lots of horses and stuff, and it's a part of their whole apparatus of war that they have to participate in these great ceremonies of violence to settle whose society will prevail and whose values will continue in history. And so this is where this comes from. It's in ancient times, it didn't degrade to the point where the aristos are just fancy characters that really don't do anything. That happens in European history. But in these ancient times, there really was no luxury involved. It happened a little bit in Rome too, to be an aristos, you had to be a capable warrior. So you can see why somebody would be able to maintain their status in a society, because they really are needed. They're needed in order to sustain the society. They got to fight the battles, and those battles are glorious. And those battles are told in epic poems. And everybody will tell the story of those warriors forever. And guess what? They do, right? I mean, that is the theme of the movie Troy, is that in the eternity of the repute of the great warriors. And that's what they're fighting for. They want to be known forever. And so here we have the eupatric concept. Here we have the aristocracy concept, at least as it applied in those archaic times. So how do we get... I mean, this is not really a step towards democracy, though, right? I mean, this is, if you want to put it in a clever sort of way, you could say aristocracy is government of the best, by the best, and for the best. Right? It's a kind of elitism, and it's not... This is not a step towards democracy. This is just a group of elite people who are claiming the right to rule. Okay? So they're taking power away from the modernity, and they're kind of distributing it. And it becomes more and more distributed over time in this aristocracy. So we don't have clear dates. Eventually, the kingship even became annual. In other words, they voted every year for a new king. Still elective, but not decennial anymore. It was annual. And then the power of the king was divided among 9 archons. So notice here in the word archon, again, common root words. Right? We have the word monarchy. Arch is a ruler, again, very similar to krasi, similar, you know, kind of synonymous words. So an archon was a ruler. And they served different functions, but basically the power of the king was kind of distributed among a board of 9 different officials with slightly different responsibilities. So this is kind of interesting, because you're getting what later on in history we call the separation of powers. Right? So when the founding fathers were looking at creating a republic, now this was something that interested them. Some people look back on Athenian government during this time, and they talk about the so-called Athenian Republic. So sometimes you'll hear that term used to describe Athens at different stages in what I still think the best term here is aristocracy. But it's interesting because we're seeing features in the way that the aristocracy is forming its government that later become a part of what is a good republic. So the separation of powers here, where the king doesn't rule, but instead you have 9 people ruling, and they're elective officials, and But they're still all part of the aristocracy. So it's still far from what we would call democracy, and it's still very far from what we would call republic as well, because there's no premise here whatsoever that we're talking about the defense of individual rights. We're talking about the distribution of power. Okay, so that's why, for me personally, I'm not satisfied to refer to this Athenian society as being a republic, even though sometimes you'll hear that used. I think that's a confusion. And so this is definitely has essential features of an aristocracy, and maybe some accidental features of a republic, but without the premise that is at the root of every real republic, which is the protection of the rights of the individual. So you don't quite get that. But it's interesting because it just starts to move in a kind of peculiar direction, because this whole, pardon me, my throat is starting to give out on me. So it's good we're getting to the end here. But the way that wars were fought started to change. And as a result, the Eupatrids became relatively less important to the way that wars were fought in Greece. And it had to do with an innovation that makes its way into various warring societies at different times. In fact, if we go back to Mesopotamia, which is pretty cool, we see the very first example, as far as I know, of this type of arrangement. And this says here that this was a Sumerian phalanx. This is the formation that we're going to be talking about here. Well, you can see that warriors would set up in a very systematic arrangement right next to each other, and they would line up their shields. And through holes in the shields, or through just slight arrangements, right, you got the hands here, their spears would be pointing through there, and you'd get this very, very tight formation. And this made every individual soldier less important in a way. And in another sense, it made every individual soldier more important because each of them, no matter kind of their social status, if they had a spear and a shield, well, they could be a part of this formation. Here's a photograph of, I don't know if it's a photograph or it looks like a computerized image to kind of represent the same thing. Right, so they're very, very regular arrangement. And then the soldiers have their shields, probably even more tightly packed than this, and then spears. And then they advance in unison, and they work together as part of the battle. So each individual soldier doesn't have the same important role that he used to have. And so if you've seen the movie 300... which is gory and comic book like and everything, but it has its value. This is one of the scenes from the movie The 300, where the Spartan soldiers, which we'll talk about later on, are lined up with their shields and their spears in this phalanx formation. And in the movie, you see the onslaught of the Persian army coming. And they run up against this and force them back, but they move in unison, they absorb the pressure in unison, and they return the force in unison, and everything works as a very coordinated unit. So you can see that in this arrangement, not one person stands out, right? What matters is the collective effort. What matters is the organization. So each of the individual soldiers plays the same fractional role. You don't have that, again, that individual kind of Eupatrid, Aristos type of role in the battle. Everybody is kind of more equally important. So this is going to lead to a significant change in the culture as well, okay? Because common soldiers now are going to start to be not as important, okay, but more important, okay, to the defense of the city. as part of the phalanx formation. So, this is going to erode the Aristos concept, right? Because the Aristos concept relies a lot on, I'm the guy that fights the big battles. I'm the big deal. Well, no longer, right? Because if you want to win the battle, you've got to get into the formation. You can't have individuals. Because the practical, you know, if the practical emphasis on winning the war rather than performing the ceremony of war, right, is what this kind of introduces. War is, if you're going to have to fight it, it's brutal and it's horrible. And so what you want to do is you want to organize as well as you can, defeat your enemy, and get back to your life. And that's what the phalanx formation allows you to do. It gives you a really efficient method of coordinating the warriors in their effort and gives you an advantage on the battlefield. So what we're going to see starting tomorrow is, all right, this translates into, like I said, an erosion of the concept of the Aristos. Because the commoner, not all the way down to the base, you know, the lowest farmer or workman or whatever, but anybody that could participate at this level had an important role and thus had a voice, right? Because they were equally important in this crucial function in the society. So if you're a person that the city needs, then you have leverage, right? You have the ability to say to people, I want a role. I want to speak in this government also. So that's going to be the next evolution here. We're going to go to an even more distributed form of rule. And gradually we'll get to the most distributed form of all, which is democracy. All right, but that'll do it for today. Alrighty. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye, Mr. Powell.